Welcome to the Subject Composition and Light Photography Podcast. Show notes, links, and contact details can be found at robnunphoto.com. That's www.robnunphoto.com. SCL is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network, and loads of other great tech podcasts can be found over at www.techpodcast.com. Now on with the show. Good evening and welcome to SCL, the Subject Composition and Light Photography Podcast for the 6th of September 2010. This is show number 112. Well, first, my apologies for loading this cast a little bit late into the stream. Normally I record it on a Sunday night, but this week did on Monday. Just too much other things going on. We've actually started a new, well not new, we've got an allotment locally, which Suzanne's allotment, and whenever I can, we're going to be down there in the evening, sort of digging things up and growing our own fruit and vegetables, so that should be really, really cool. But we've already got apples, which is really excellent, because there's already a tree there, and they're really tasty and juicy, and so last night we were just clearing away some of the weeds, and we're just going to be turning it all over, preparing it for the winter. And do we plant anything in the winter, Suzanne? Not this year, no. We're just going to prepare anything for the new planting we'll do in the spring. So, what am I going to talk about this week? Well, this week, what I thought I'd talk about a little bit is some really good bargains that Suzanne got me from the car boot sale this week, and Oliver got me, because it was bank holiday in the UK last week, and also a little bit on the end about sort of personal projects and moving forward with those, because I've kind of stumbled a little bit on the projects I was planning to do for 2010, and I think I just need to refocus on the things I was going to do. So first things up, Suzanne and Oliver, I was working on Bank Holiday Monday, and Suzanne and Oliver came back from the local car boot sales with some fantastic little bargains. First up was a Fujika ST605 35mm camera. Now Fujika, I think they're now known as Fujifilm, and this is a 35mm film SLR with a 55mm f2.2 lens on it, made in Japan. The camera body itself is very reminiscent of the Minolta SRT101, in the fact that it's an aluminium cast body with a simple light meter that you can see in the through the viewfinder. This one, I haven't actually taken the battery out to see what type of cells it uses, but at the moment it doesn't appear to be working. I can't see any other switches, but I'll be checking that out. It's very, very clean, no scratches, no fungus, looks like a very nice little 35mm camera, and a kind of a forebear of the S5700, which I used to use, which Suzanne still uses, and which I still record my videos with. So a nice little bit of Fuji history there. I'm looking forward to using that one. Now the other thing they came back with, oh, and the Fujika was about £4 or £5, I think, something like that. But the other camera they came back with was another Polaroid, and you may say, oh, not another Polaroid, Rob, you haven't even got any film for them. And while, yes, that is true, I don't actually have any film for them, this one, much to my surprise, when I aimed it at Suzanne and then Oliver, it had a couple of films left inside. So when I pressed the button, there was a a Polaroid popped out the front. Now, they paid about £1 for this camera, and the Polaroid Impulse is, it's a plastic body camera. It's very much like the later Fujifilm 600 series clamshell Polaroids that kind of open up. Well, the ones before that used SX70 film were either fold down, and if you ever see an SX70 fold down Polaroid, pick it up because they're worth quite a bit on eBay. But the other ones were like a plastic body, quite low profile, still big old cameras though. And what this is the Polaroid Impulse Portrait, which means that it has a little lever that you press, and when you press that in, it brings over a close-up filter over the lens so that you can focus closer. And anyway, so I pressed the button and bzzzt, a picture popped out, and then I pointed at Oliver and bzzzt, another picture pointed out. And I was really pleased to see that they actually did come out, these Polaroids, even though the film could be, I don't know, if we open it up, let's have a look. The film, the camera was made in America. I don't think there's any dates, but I mean, it must be at least 20 years old, I would guess. So the film is, what happened with most Polaroids is people bought them, bought a couple of packs of film, used it all up, realised how expensive the film was and stopped using them and went over to 35mm. So the film could be 20 years old, but the battery was still good enough to use, and produced a couple of okay photographs. What actually did happen is they came out very yellow and very kind of faded, but that's quite a nice look, I think. I was well chuffed. At least I know, therefore, that Polaroid impulse works, and also it means that I've got a 600 cartridge that's empty, obviously no film in it, but I've got a 600 cartridge with a battery that I know is good. Now, I think on the last podcast they talked about taking some film out of some expired SX70 film where the battery was flat in the cartridge, and putting it into a different cartridge and seeing if that would work. I gave it a go and it didn't work, nothing happened, because the film kept jamming up inside both the cameras I had, so that was a bit of a failure. But it was nice to get some Polaroids that came out. Now, the other things that they got me as well were some brilliant books that it's worth looking out for next time you're down the local car boot sale. The first one was by a guy named Charlie Waite, and it was called The Making of Landscape Photographs, A Practical Guide to the Art and Techniques. And this is a great book, because although it's it refers mainly to film, the other stuff like composition and use of great light and use of filters, things like that, is still applicable today. And best of all, there's loads of fantastic examples of lovely landscape photography in this one. Whenever you're down the car boot sale or second-hand shops or thrift stores or garage sales, you know a good photo book when you open it up and it's got beautiful looking photographs inside. Because even then, if it's a making of book that you might not be particularly interested in, if you look at the photographs and think, that looks nice, buy it. So that's a really good book. The photographs remind me of, and I don't know who came first, but Lee Frost. In fact, I think I might have looked at this book before, got it out from the library. But it's full of fantastic colour landscape photographs that are really inspirational. And it's all about the light, really. It's all about getting up at the right time of day and not taking pictures in the middle of the noonday sun, but rather waiting for the light to be a little bit more pretty and a little bit more soft. But that's a beautiful book. So that's The Making of Landscape Photographs by Charlie Waite. Another really nice book was called Hollywood Portraits by Roger Hicks and Christopher Nispiros, with photographs from the Cobalt collection. And this is very much in the terms of like the Strobis website. And what it does, it takes classic, iconic Hollywood pictures, right from the opening bars, if you like, of Hollywood from 1910, 1920s, right through to the 1950s. So we have pictures of people like Fred Astaire, Rudolph Valentino, Greta Garbo. Here we've got famous ones. Who else have we got? Cary Grant. Vivian Lee, Rita Hayworth, Lana Turner, Roy Rogers, Ingrid Bergman, Veronica Lake, Marlon Brando, and it finishes off with a portrait of Elvis Presley. And what they do in the book is that they analyse how the light stands were set up and the camera was set up for each of these photographs, so that you can get an appreciation of the work that went into lots of these photographs, but how you could also perhaps reproduce them yourself. And what makes this book stand out is the quality of the printing. The photographs are big, nice prints, so they're nice black and white prints and toned prints. But also, you know, it gives you an idea of what these guys went through to create these photographs. And there's also some interesting behind the scenes photographs occasionally, where you see the guys, the photographers, using these big view cameras and all these massive hot lights to create these quite startling and iconic pictures of Hollywood film stars. And that's called Hollywood Portraits, Classic Shots and How to Take Them by Roger Hicks and Christopher Nisperos. What else have we got? Another one that's really nice is called Toning and Hand Colouring Photographs by Tony Worobig. That's Worobig. And this is all about adding a little bit of colour back into black and white photographs. You know how, you know, we think of black and white. But often black and white photographs look a little bit more interesting if they've got a little bit of a tone to them, whether that be a sepia tone or a blue tone. And funnily enough, this is something I've thought about a lot and done a lot previously in my black and whites, is what I tend to like to do is add a little bit of blue to the images, because what blue does, it tends to make them a little bit cooler. But I find that when I look at black, maybe it's the way my monitor's set up, but when I look at black and white photographs on my monitor, often they look a little bit warm. I don't know why, maybe it's my eyes, but I find that when they've got a slight hint of blue to them, they look more black and white than when they're not. And this book goes into great detail, really talking about toning in terms of film toning, so adding different colours to developers, I guess, and things like that. But we can apply these very easily using to digital with Photoshop and photo editing programs, because you can add filters. You know, you can add a sepia filter, you can add a warming filter, you can add cooling filters, or if you're using something like Nick Silver X Pro, there's a whole gamut of different toning techniques you can put on, through to single tones like sepia or selenium, through to split toning effects where you add, you know, things like a copper tone maybe to the highlight, to the lighter parts of the photograph, and maybe a selenium tone to the low lights or the darker parts of the photograph. So a really nice book. When I read the sort of blurb at the front, I thought, well, you know, I don't have a dark room, I don't do that sort of developing, I don't create those sort of pictures. But as soon as I started looking at the images and reading some of the text around it, I thought, yeah, you know, it is something you do kick around when you take a lot of black and white, well, create black and white photographs, and the fact that, you know, do you add a tone to give them that little bit extra? And that's got a nice discussion in there. So that was Toning and Hand Colouring Photographs by Tony Worobig. And finally, the last book was a guy called John Hedgecoe. You may well have heard of him. I created hundreds and hundreds of photo books, as it seems, and there's always loads of his ones at the car boot sales. And this one is called John Hedgecoe Portraits. And what it is, it's a collection of his best work over the last 40 years. And also a little bit of blurbs and explanation behind the images as well, a little bit of the backstory about who the people were and where he took the photographs, and a little bit on how he took them. And this is really nice, because most of John Hedgecoe's books that I've got tend to be how-tos, but this is just purely like a resume of his portraits, and you know, just a nice photo book to look through, to enjoy the images and to kind of imprint them on your subconscious, so the next time you're out and about taking photographs, those subconscious images can come to the fore unconsciously and influence your photography to create, hopefully, better images. Now, finally, Oliver found a camera for me at a local second-hand shop on Saturday, just gone. And this is one that I've been looking for a long time. It's a little film 35mm camera, a very famous one, the Olympus Trip 35. You may well remember it for adverts from the 1970s and 1980s, where David Bailey used to be generally taking photographs, and someone would come up to him and say, "Who do you think you are, David Bailey?" And this is it, and I've got a working, clean example. And you may say, well, what's so special about the Olympus Trip? And, you know, last time I was talking about the fact that I picked up the Olympus Mu 2 or Olympus Epic last week, which is a very nice little point-and-shoot 35mm with a 2.8 lens, fully automatic, or electronic wind on and everything like that. But the Olympus Trip 35 is a fully automatic camera that requires no batteries. I guess that's probably the easiest way to talk about it. Fully automatic, apart from focusing, you've got to do that yourself. And what it is, it's a small 35mm point and shoot. You know, it's got a little viewfinder you look through to compose your pictures. It's got a 40mm focal length lens, so a little bit wider than a standard, and it's got an f2.8 aperture on it, nice and fast. And what makes it stand out is the fact that it uses a selenium, I think they call it, powered photo cell to power the exposure controls. And the way it works is you simply turn the aperture ring to A for automatic, point the camera at your subject, compose it, press the button halfway down, and it will then choose one of two shutter speeds, either a 40th or a 200th of a second, and then it will just change the aperture to get the correct exposure. Now, to set your focus, on the focus ring there's like little icons of like a person with their body, two people, so it's further away, a group of people, or the mountains, and they correspond to 1 meter, 1.5 meters, 3 meters, and infinity. Or if you look on the bottom of the focus ring, there's actually a proper distance scale with 1, 1.5, 3 meters, or the equivalent in feet. And what will happen is if you're in somewhere where it's actually a little bit too dark, when you press the button halfway down, the camera actually pops a little red tongue in the viewfinder, so you can't actually take a photograph. And it's saying, no, you can't take a photograph because with the type of film you've put in and the maximum aperture, f2.8, and the slowest shutter speed, I can't get a correct exposure. So in that situation, what you then do is you fit a flash to the top on the hot shoe, and you change the aperture ring to anything from f2.8 through f22, combined with the distance to your subject, and at 40th of a second, and select the correct aperture for the correct flash exposure, and it works that way. Or the other thing you can do is you can put it to f2.8, the camera will automatically shoot at a 40th because that's the slowest shutter speed it can choose, and then you just take the photograph and just trust that, you know, there's enough light to get a decent image. So it's very, very simple. Once you've loaded it up your film, the only thing you have to worry about is, apparently, the only thing that's a little bit suspect about them is if the selenium cell gets damaged, because if you left it out in a hot sunny day on the top of a table and exposing the selenium cell that's around the lens to constant sunlight all day, that could damage the cell and burn it out. But otherwise, that's it. There's no battery to run out. It's very simple. It's all mechanical, apart from the simple electrics that change the aperture for the correct exposure. And it's a very nice little metal cased camera, so I'm looking forward to taking some shots with that. I've loaded it up with some Fuji ISO 200 film, and it should be a good one. Should be an interesting little project to play around with and see what the photographs are like. The lens on it is very highly rated. Lots of people think that the Zuiko Japanese made f2.8 40mm lens was a real good un, as they say, and produces some fantastically sharp images. Next up is a little message from our sponsors, GoToMeeting. As you know, GoToMeeting is a way that you can have a meeting with clients or potential customers or existing customers or employees, colleagues all over the world via voice over internet and via the phone basically. But the difference between GoToMeeting and ordinary conference calls is that with GoToMeeting, the people on the other end of the line can actually see your computer screen. So if you're having a sales meeting, for example, you can show them the pie charts, the line charts, the bar charts. You can show them the latest facts and figures for how things are going, rather than just having to listen to you read out from a piece of paper. If you're trying to show a new potential customer about a new product line or some new prices or some photographs of how they would be using your product, instead of having to just tell them and them say, well, yeah, you know, just throw a catalogue into the post, you can say to them, look, tell you what, look, have you got, you sitting in front of your PC? Yeah. Okay. What I want you to do is I want you to go to gotomeeting.com, and they sign in with just a little meeting ID which you give them, and then bang, they can see your computer screen. And so then you've got a proper interactive meeting where you can actually be showing people stuff just as you would if you were there having a meeting in person with your laptop, with your PowerPoint presentation, using a projector, but you can do it from the comfort of your own office or your own home. But more importantly, you're saving money because you're not having to pay for the fuel, the transport, the accommodation as if you were going to meetings all over the country or even over all over the world. So all you've got to do, try GoToMeeting out free for 30 days. Just go to the URL gotomeeting.com/techpodcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/techpodcasts. Try it out free for 30 days and then you'll probably want to become a member and start subscribing. Now back to the final part of tonight's podcast, which is just a short word on projects, because some of this came out of another podcast I've started listening to actually called Film Wasters. And just do a Google search for Film Wasters, or in iTunes search for Film Wasters, and I've been catching up some of the episodes. One of the things they talk about, obviously, is film photography, but they're not quite as, they don't talk about film photography as much as on the Film Photography podcast, but they talk a lot more about different issues related to photography as well, even though it has a bit of a, the people who are talking about it tend to be focused on film. But one of the things that really spoke to me was when they were talking about projects, because I've tried to do some projects for 2010, and I have started taking quite a few images, but one of the things I've thought about is I enjoy going out and taking random photographs, and if you check my Flickr photo stream, you'll find a set, in fact I'll put a link to the show notes, the set of my photographs I've took on the Isle of Wight, the ones I took with my mobile phone, and also the ones I took with the S5000 with a Canon 350D digital SLR, and they're all up now and you can have a look, and yeah, some were quite nice, and that was a nice project. You could say there was a beginning and an end with the Isle of Wight photographs. You know, we went, I took photographs while I was there just of the things we were going to see, and then it finished, and so that set is finished. And I think I really need to get more practice at doing very short projects that have a definite start and a definite finish, and once they're done, they're done. And maybe I'll do a little, you know, a set on Flickr of them, or on rubnonphoto.com I'll create a little gallery with the photographs, just to get myself into the practice of working with short, sharp projects to create little bodies of work that are on a similar theme or have a similar look, because I'm really aware that that's the way that you can keep your photography going when you run out of ideas, if you've got some projects to work on. And I think I'm just going to start off with some really simple projects. So for example, my first project is probably going to be instant film cameras. So you know, like how I have instant film cameras, well I'm going to take pictures of them, and it's going to be, I don't know, 6 or 7 photographs of the instant film cameras I know. Then the next project related to that will be 10 shots from the Fuji Instax Mini. So I'm going to take one cartridge, load it up, and I'm going to take 10 shots using that camera around Gosport, or maybe just around Elson, and that'll be it. So there you go. So it gives you an idea, they're really short projects that I could probably even do in a day if I wanted to. They're not these big long projects that are gonna, that have been taking me months and months to do. Because I mean, and this is another mistake on my part, and apologies, you know, even last year's project that we did for where I live, I still haven't got around to creating the photo book for that, and we're in August now, aren't we? No, we're in September, you know, and I feel really bad about that, and I will get around to it someday, I promise. But anyway, so there we go. I'm going to be thinking about short, really short, sharp projects that I can start getting into the idea of becoming not only a photographer who just happens to have a camera on him and takes photographs of things he finds interesting when he's wandering around, or I go to places and look for things that are interesting, but also I've got these projects on the go, which may be lots of different subjects. So maybe a little bit of food for thought. Email me or go on the Flickr, rubnonphoto.com Flickr group, and you know, maybe put down ideas for projects you're working on. I mean, the big project that I have, I guess, that I'm continually working on is my Flickr slideshow, which you can see if you come to rubnonphoto.com and click on slideshow in the all the links that are near the top of the page. There's like this collection of images that from my Flickr photo stream that whenever I take a picture that I think, oh, that's quite good, I add it to my Flickr slideshow, so you can sit there and I guess look through what I think are my best images of the past 2 years. But lots of those, they're not related to each other. Apart from the thing that brings them all together is that they're a collection of photographs in time order that I think are okay. There's nothing within that group of photographs. As the time rolls on, you'll find groups of photographs that are similar to each other, but there's no overall theme. And I think I need to create these little projects so then I can start saying, okay, so that was a nice little project, I've done it, let's do another little one. Right, I'm ready to take on something bigger, rather than trying to take on a big project that I don't complete and will put me off project making. Whew, so there we go. That's it for this week. Thank you for commenting on the robnonphoto.com blog. Thank you for taking part and putting your pictures in the most excellent robnonphoto.com Flickr group, and I'll post links as ever on the robnonphoto.com website. There's some brilliant work there. If ever I want any inspiration, I just go over there, and I will do over the next couple of weeks. I think I'm going to do another one of those podcasts where I look at some images from the group and talk about why I like them and maybe the things we can learn from those images. Thanks to Everyday Jones, who do the intro and outro music for the podcast. You can find their stuff for free download at podsafeaudio.com. But most of all, thanks to you for downloading and listening to the podcast. My name's Rob from robnonphoto.com. Remember, you can email me, scalespeeder@gmail.com, with any ideas, comments, questions, anything like that. But hopefully, pretty soon, I'll be seeing you on Flickr.